Now on Mitchell's Front Page, Talking Freely with Stephanie Asher.
Good morning, Steph. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Mitchell. And you?
Yeah, very well indeed. But a lot's happened since we last spoke, hasn't it?
It sure has.
Now, the local government situation, I mean, I want to hear your thoughts on what's happened. How do you think it's been handled? What did you see in the report that surprised you? Just unleash.
Look, the report was fascinating. I found it quite interesting how prescriptive the detail was in some areas with the quotes, etc. It was clearly going to end up in the media in quite a salacious manner, so I thought that was an interesting tactic. The detail of it was terrific, and I didn't disagree with any of it, really. I think that's a lot of the information is what I already knew, and I did look back at my website from 2013 and popped that up on social media because it was exactly the sort of stuff that I'd been campaigning on. So I was very aware of all those issues happening. To actually see them come to life with axe-wielding managers and expletives was quite interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. Do you think that just using expletives constitutes bullying? I was sort of raising this with breakfast this morning. I think it needs to be a bit more than that. In some corporate environments, and people are particularly frustrated, that's just par for the course, isn't it?
Look, we just had this conversation 10 seconds ago, and on the face of it, yes, it's very easy to say, and I did just say I think all of us probably read some of those examples and thought, you know, silent applause, fully agree, but as your producer, David, quite rightly pointed out, it's the person on the receiving end that's the one that's we need to be concerned with. And to receive a spray at any time is very destructive. And that goes to the core of what the behaviour's been at council. And I think people who haven't been through it don't really have any idea how destructive and soul-destroying that can be. I think Keith Fagg could probably attest to that. And you do become... you reach a point where you can't actually really think very clearly and you can't make decisions when you're in that situation. So it's a little bit like being in a war zone every day.
I think the question is it a once-off or is it happening every single day and over again for no reason?
Well, the definition of bullying is about the sustained nature of it.
It's got to be repeated, doesn't
it? That's right, and the impact on the people to whom it's being directed. So, look, I'm not going to say yes or no and charge bullying. I do think the lack of naming names is probably an issue, and I think it is a little unfair that Darren does seem to be the one who is solely named. I mean, I know exactly who they're talking about with the other quotes because the vernacular is very easy to pick up.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of the people that are quoted in there have only ever said those expressions on one occasion. So I'm pretty sure there's a large body of the community that would say they know who those other three, I think, at least three that are named in there.
Like hanging people from Queen's Park Bridge
and certain
Greek property developers or whatever
it was. And being in a dark place that you won't like and those sorts of things. You know, there is a certain ring to the expressions that we've heard. And I was interested also to note the comment from a former councillor that has been used quite frequently by a current councillor, which gave away the fact that they talk about the same things and have the same conversation.
Yeah.
So if you have a little bit of information, I think, in reading the report, you can quite easily identify who they are.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that the community meeting at which the police were called did have witnesses, so that particular councillor would not be anonymous.
There's also certain councillors that have appeared in the newspaper as being bullies in the past.
That's right, and I mean social media is fairly public by nature, so you're not very social sometimes. So yes, I think we all do know, or not everybody probably, but a lot of people would know who they are. Look, I think the main issue at the moment is what's going to happen with the administration and how do you deal with the behaviour of the council and the administrators and the interim commissioner. I think they've got quite the task ahead of them, but I'm quite excited by it because it's a great opportunity for a major culture change and a lot of engagement with the community that's been missing.
That's exactly right, but as I was saying to Andrew, we've now got to just wait until October next year, and the question is, will they get it right, or will they use an excuse and say it was too short, or will it just be more of the same? So this is a great opportunity, but let's get it right, I think is the point.
Yeah, that's right, and let's take a professional approach to this. You know, the argument, and we were having that in the hallway just outside a minute ago just then too, about how long is too long and how long is long enough to actually address the issues. And personally, coming from mostly corporate background, although I have worked worked in local government quite a bit as well. It's too slow. One of the big problems of our local government is the excuse is things take time. They don't need to, and they don't always take time. I have had people say to me, well, I can get a planning permit in half an hour if I ring this person. So, and then you speak to community members who it takes 6 months. Mm-hmm. So things can happen quickly. They should be happening quickly. And personally, I think it's akin to ripping off a Band-Aid. I think we do need to get in there, get the job done, do it quickly. It's not going to be pretty. It's going to be harsh. And I think even the people who, to some degree, are completely innocent of any poor behaviour have been affected and impacted by what's going on, that they'd be suffering something like post-traumatic stress, I think, you know, and that's what it's like in an environment like that. It really is such a thick culture of fear. And it was the first thing I noticed when I took a look at councils, because I've seen it before. And you think, wow, when it's at every level, then that's a really toxic culture.
Now, obviously with Andrew Kados, we said that 4.5 years is too long. He said that he thinks about 18 months is, well, it's a fair compromise. But then we talked about the corporate world versus the public sector. And I said in a corporate world, of course, 6 months would be more than long enough if you wanted to sack people that you thought were creating a toxic culture.
Yeah, although I think it's, you know, it's never pleasant anywhere. I'm currently at a very big corporate that's going through a very big restructure, for want of a better word, implementing a new operating model. And yeah, it's intense and it's fast paced and it's at every level, so it can be done, but it has to be well managed, and that is part of managing culture effectively and making sure that people's careers, emotions, performance, etc., is clearly managed and articulated.
And obviously, you know, you have to feel for those people, as you said, that are going through a tough time. But at the end of the day, it's the ratepayers that are picking up the bill.
Yeah.
So do their needs come first? And obviously, they would like to have their say.
Yes, I think absolutely right. And I think the 18 months is about right. I think that's a fair compromise. Others would disagree. I think a lot of people wanted an extra 12 months. Look, you could say it's going to take this long. You could say you can get it done in 6 months. We've got what we've got. I think it was a fair compromise. And I just look forward to there being some sort of rigour around how they address the issues at hand.
The other thing I was saying to Andrew was, for democracy, and I've said this on Twitter as well, I think people need to know. Because, yes, we can talk about and speculate which council has said what, and some people that are very plugged into the council have very firm ideas. But it's not really fair on those other voters that don't follow the council very closely, and they have to rely on rumour and innuendo. Surely, if we want to hold bullies to account, their names need to be published so that we can make an informed choice, because I wouldn't be surprised if most of these people don't run again next year.
Yeah, very interesting point. I never like naming names, so I prefer to steer away from that. I do think there's a huge issue with the current or the most recent council, any of those members running again. I think that's bringing a whole lot of baggage back into the fray that could be avoided. The ones who are not guilty of any poor behaviour, if they have the patience to wait until the following election, then I think that would be the most dignified thing to do, just to allow a fresh council. I've always said I think the term should be four years, and that's it.
Yeah.
One term. If you can't get what you need done in 4 years, then you're not doing a good enough job. Get out. To have 8 years in that role is too long.
Yeah, no, that's probably a fair point. And I heard someone else talking about it in a major political party about the process. And, you know, you've talked about using local government as a training ground, but they said serving one term in local government's a good service to the community. Two terms is madness. Three terms is suicide.
Well, I would say dangerous and fraught with opportunity for misbehaviour and corruption. And I've seen, you know, when you've come from suburban Melbourne and inner suburban Melbourne and you don't even know who your councillors are, they don't rate on the radar, it's not really in the news that much, nobody really cares. To come to this region and see the power that is wielded by those councillors and the reverence that is attributed to them quite unfairly, in my view, in a lot of cases, it's actually quite staggering. You think, what on earth are these people thinking? This isn't what a councillor should be doing. They're just public service volunteers, essentially.
Yeah. And the media is very different here compared to, for example, if you're in the Glen Eira Council, because in Glen Eira you've got that leader newspaper which goes around, but not too many people read it. It's a free newspaper, mostly full of ads. Whereas here we have a very high quality publication called the Geelong Advertiser,
which
is daily, and it's got all sorts of great news and information. We've got local radio stations, commercial and community, of course, that just focus on Geelong. So it's a very different media landscape to if you've got your in a city council.
Absolutely, yeah, totally agree. And, you know, the daily nature of it, the tabloid nature of it, and a lot of people do, you know, get the knives out for the addy and say they do the wrong thing, and it's actually exactly doing what it should be doing. Tabloid is by nature sensationalist, and that's what they do, and they do it really well. So, like it or lump it, if you don't like it, don't buy it, but if you want to know what's going on, then you essentially do buy it in Geelong, don't you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And just last of all, before we move on to something else, we were talking with Andrew also just after his segment finished about how they would go about the process of bringing in new administrators, because we've got the one administrator, he's on that page 13 of the paper today, but they're going to bring in more, obviously. And how do you just balance, for example, you know, what side of politics they come from and all of those sorts of murky issues?
Well, it'll be very, very interesting to watch. You'd hope that they're not politically aligned one way or the other, and that the focus is on bringing an informed, and I would say local insight. I think a mix of people from within and without the region would be useful. A mix of experience in local government and people who are actually bringing some fresh eyes to the situation, and obviously people who are well versed in accountability and change management.
Now, federal government, anything to note there? We've got 75 days until a most likely election is going to happen, 2 weeks till the budget.
Yeah, it could be an interesting day today, won't it? And an interesting week this week. I was interested to see the little article in the Sunday Age about Michael Kroger's point about pushing a deal with the Greens, and just whether the Liberals will actually swap preference deals with the Greens in some of the sort of suburban electorates. And not least, actually, the fact that it did create some consternation in the Liberal Party, but also the fact that I didn't realise, but prior to 2010, that was fairly standard. They did preference the Greens over the ALP.
Yeah, they did.
It was actually in the 2010 state election when Ted Baillieu won that they made that decision to put the Greens last in all the 88 lower house seats.
So I still remember the 2010 federal, and they put the Greens above Labor. Labor was last on the ballot paper.
Yeah. So it does obviously move around quite a bit. So it'll just be interesting to see. I think we'll probably have more to say next week, won't we, on Anzac Day?
I think we probably will. It is interesting because the Liberal Party, they're not happy about the idea of putting the Greens above Labor, because if you were a true Liberal, presumably you'd put Greens below Labor if you were voting. But at the same time, the preference deals are obviously tempting, and some of the benefits that come with it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think Michael Kroger rationalised it by saying that the Greens are not the nutters that they used to be, quote unquote.
Yep. Or Richard Di Natale might have something to say about that.
Well, I think he's probably got a lot to do with that perception as
well.
Yeah, he does. Because he is an extraordinarily rational person, isn't he?
That's right, and he's got a very good media manner, very calm and reassuring. And also, of course, the two seats of interest are Grindler and Sydney. This is in New South Wales, but they say that if the Liberals preference the Greens, then Tanya Plibersek and Anthony Albanese will be out of a job.
Yeah, that'd cause a few waves, just
quietly. Right. I was interested to read your piece in the Advertiser about public transport, and you say that you're a bit of a convert, because I know that we've spoken a lot, and you say that you need cars for reliability, but times have changed, have they?
Yes, absolutely. I'm absolutely passionate about it now. I did bite the bullet during the school holidays, and the traffic was just ridiculous prior to that. And because of this, you know, I had actually somebody question whether I was telling the truth about my $80 a day in parking. I can absolutely attest that it's actually $82.50 when you factor in the credit card payment. But that was to be at the building that I needed to be at the time, in the way that I needed to be. And so
you're not getting there at 6 a.m. and getting the early bird.
No, I was
special.
Missing the early bird because I had other commitments. So it was a whole range of reasons that was actually what I was actually experiencing. But when I did try the train instead, because I'd been under the impression that it was unreliable and it had been a few years ago, and there wasn't enough parking at Marshall Station a few years ago, et cetera, et cetera. Plenty of parking at Marshall Station, very reliable trains. I've had absolutely A1 experience, and I am now catching it every day. I've got Mikey card is easy. The whole system's easy. I've just found it. And for me, the biggest shock has been the extra time in the day that I get. You know, I can actually read. I can work on the train, whereas obviously in the car, you're trapped in your little cubicle just with frustration at 2.5 hour journeys. And 2.5 hours on the way in, it was taking me, and often two on the way back or more. So 4.5 to 5 hours a day and I get paid by the hour, wasted, which was fairly ridiculous. So I'm loving the train, and I've got nothing but good things to say about V-Line. Yep, there's occasionally little disruptions here and there, but on the whole, it's been a really good experience.
So. Well, maybe if you'd made your switch a few months ago, it might have been different with the whole coach situation.
True, and I think probably timing is part of it, but timing's everything, isn't it?
That's right.
You also pick a time when they're under the hammer and trying to do a good job. And there are coaches every alternate service is a coach, and I was at Marshall Station last week sometime, and the scheduled train, we got an announcement saying that train was going to be replaced by a coach because there were no seats. And I actually raised the question, it's only come from Warren Ponds, where near the end of the line, why would there be no seats already? There's no seats, but you can elect to take the coach if you'd so like. Well, I elected not to. I waited for the next train.
Yeah.
But everybody on the station pretty much got on that train. There were seats. They were just trying to discourage people from using that train because they'd sent a shorter train, taking some carriages off. So I think, you know, if you look a bit harder and know the system a little more clearly, it all
That's
gets
right.
easier.
Yep, and there's public transport veterans that do it every day, and they've got it down to a fine art.
That's right, and I wouldn't like to be forced to do it, and I think that's probably the difference. If I was forced to do it in peak hour and, you know, completely reliant on it, then I might have a bit of a gripe. But I do have the virtue of flexibility, and I can travel off-peak when I want to. So
the 20-minute services as well has made a big difference in off-peak, not having to wait the hour.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so same with the free trams in Melbourne CBD as well. That's very easy to just jump out at Southern Cross and jump on the tram at Collins Street or Bourke Street and go up. Very easy.
What about the regional rail link going through Tarneet and all that? Do you notice any difficulties or frustrations with that?
Haven't so far, but I don't want to moz myself, so I'll touch wood while I say that.
Now, Target, it's very interesting, but my point earlier today was, why do they have to move to Melbourne? Are their operating costs cheaper there? Are they trying to get rid of Geelong staff? Is there a broader talent pool in Melbourne? What's going on?
Well, I totally disagree that there's a broader talent pool, but look, just to sort of backtrack, that news last week was pretty devastating, and say, as you said, it was buried, rather, wasn't it, with the council news, and I think it was quite unexpected. Looking back now, it seems the problems have been at Target for quite a long time. And for me, it's not just the financial issues, but there's clearly a big problem with ethics going on. The rebate scandal last month, I looked at it and thought, that is so appalling, it's almost funny. But for the solution to be pulling out of Geelong made it very not funny, didn't it, for the region down here. There was a really good detailed article in the Fin Review last week. I'll try and summarise it quickly. The upshot is that Target was prone to asking for a range of advance payments from its suppliers, and it ventured into this big no-no last month, which was described as breathtakingly stupid by the managing director of Wesfarmers, when the local CEO decided to account for rebates that were due in 6 months in their current reporting figures. So that was to make the business look a whole lot healthier than it actually is. Like, that was never going to be found out. So the rebate scandal is one thing, but the advance payments are what kind of gets my goat on a local level, because Target was insisting on these upfront payments from small local suppliers. So small businesses were being asked to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in advance for promotion and advertising, which wasn't necessarily line item accounted for either. And there was no clarity around what they were actually for. So one supplier did insist on purchase orders to back up the request and account for some of the advance money, at which point Target backed off from the request. So that was interesting. And according to the article, because they'd interviewed quite a few of the local senior managers, it's standard practice to test suppliers in this way and just to see if Target can get away with charging certain people without sharing any of that risk. So, and I kind of think, you know, we've reached a point, haven't we, where it's clear that focusing on just making money in the short term isn't the answer. We have worked that out already, haven't we? Don't we realise? So what are these CEOs doing?
Yeah.
Would be my question. And I just think the fact that we have any tolerance for that is just business idea to explain unethical decisions, that's one thing. But it's really pathetic when it doesn't even make them any money.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of levels. And, you know, to do all that sort of stuff and then say that you have to pull out of Geelong for supposed cost efficiency reasons is ridiculous. Frank Costa was quite right. How can it be possibly more cost-effective to move headquarters to Melbourne? I mean, you just say that sentence and think about it.
The operational costs there are always higher, aren't they?
Absolutely. Staff costs apparently are higher, although I have no idea why people in Geelong would be paid less than people in Melbourne.
Supply and demand?
Stridently resist that. No, there's another discussion there for another day.
All right.
The money is there, but somehow it's like Geelong people don't get paid, but if you're from Melbourne, you do. So it's odd, but then, yeah, anyway.
We'll talk about that
another time.
Yep.
Hopefully Frank Costa can talk some sense into the people at Wesfarmers anyway.
Mm.
And kind of going back to the very guts of it all, I'd propose that anyone can see that Target's brand and the business strategy is a bit all over the place, just quietly. Mm. Michael Betts commented on the weekend in the Addy that his father, who established Target, was very strict about its premise. It was mass merchandising and discount retailing. And for me, it's the place you go to when you want sort of cheap price but good quality, plain underwear, T-shirts, socks, those sorts of things. And then it wandered off into this pseudo-designer label territory that it's just become irrelevant. It's not good enough to be a designer store, and it's not cheap and plain anymore. So what is it? I think the massive brand confusion there that I don't know what they were doing. So, you know, you can put up with no service and a high daggy factor if it's sort of cheap and plain, but
true.
When it's telling me I should be buying Stella McCartney at top of the sort of cheap end or bottom of the season prices, I'm not really that interested.
That's true. Just last of all, this NAB sponsorship thing, this was on the front cover of The Age on Saturday, where it talked about NAB sponsoring a Higgins 200 Club event, which was in support of Kelly O'Dwyer, the local member there, a budget breakfast event. What do you make of that, given, of course, that we're having this backwards and forwards now about Royal Commissions and banks?
Yeah, very interesting, isn't it? It seems that nobody can come out of this banking discussion clean. I look at it, and I was reading Inside Canberra last night, and Labor calling for a Royal Commission into the banking industry is kind of interesting, even given that it says it wasn't publicly disclosed. The fact that the latest alleged offences by Westpac, which was the issue with the bank bill swap rate and the trader buying significant amounts to actually impact the interest rate, that happened and caused the demand for the Royal Commission. That happened in 2010 when Bill Shorten was Minister for Financial Affairs. So nobody's really blameless, are they? And I just think the whole banking sector needs a very good hard look, and ASIC is the first port of call.
So you say yes to a Royal Commission or no?
In stages. No yes or no. I would say let's put the pressure on ASIC first and find out what's happening there, and just a lot of clarity on a lot of things, you know, some accountability and what are we trying to do, and let's focus on the job at hand.
Because as I was saying on Monday last week, what are the terms of references? It seems still very broad, and you have to be very careful. On social media, it seems that people are just calling Royal Commissions for everything now. We need a Royal Commission into politicians' pay and entitlements. We need a Royal Commission into this. Just massive overkill.
Yeah, absolutely, and they're expensive, and, you know, a lot of people do point out that the lawyers are the ones that make a lot of money out of it, and you know, it is the joy of the commissioner, and really, where do they go? What's the result? If we're looking at a Royal Commission, what are the outcomes?
And this inquiry into the Council of Geelong got plenty of information. It didn't need to be a Royal Commission.
No.
Has put together a very detailed report.
Right.
So you don't need the full powers of a Royal Commission for everything. Sometimes there are other mechanisms and instruments you can use.
Indeed. And raising that too, you think they got all that work done and made all those discoveries and documented it in 3 short months.
Yep. That's very good. Well, nice to speak with you. We'll catch up with you on Anzac Day.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Mitchell.
Good
Have
on
a
you.
Week.
Stephanie Asher there, 28 after 10, a break, and Monday Sport coming up next.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.